House Education Committee is called to order. Today's Friday, February 3, 2012. The time is 8:05. President Dar, Representative Hagee, Representative Seaton, Representative Piggy Wilson is not here. Representative Sisson is not here yet. Representative Kawasaki is here. Vice Chairman Representative Pruitt's here, and myself, Representative Allen Dick. We do have a quorum. I'd like to invite. I encourage everybody to turn off your cell phones, spare yourself the embarrassment, and we do have a really full agenda today. I'd like to remind everybody, direct questions through the chair, and I'll call you just as quickly as I can. First order of business is to back up with our presentations by school superintendents, and you need to know why we're looking forward to this. I mean, this is a really meaningful part of our meetings last year, so thank you for being here, sir. Superintendent Scott Butterfield is here to help us understand the Chatham School District. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony, sir.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Scott Butterfield. I'm the superintendent, as you know, for the Chatham School District. I'd like to say thank you for this opportunity, Chairman Dick and other members of the House Education Committee. The Chatham School District is in this area of Southeast Alaska. It's a district of a little bit of size, roughly size of Rhode Island. We have our mission statement that has been reviewed periodically.
Don't know which box here. Thank you.
And while we're looking, I really wish we would focus on the mission statement, because we will refer to this later in committee later. Excuse me, can we go back to the mission statement?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're going crazy now. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We take our time.
If I get over here, I think I can manage now. A little different
form. There we are.
There we go.
Right.
Sorry about that.
Almost had to call in a teenager.
Yeah, that's right.
Our district tries to keep in mind that our communities, as I'll talk to you about in a few minutes, is very unique, we believe, and that each of the four communities wants to be recognized as such. So one of the challenges when you have unique communities is to allow that uniqueness to exist but also function still as a district. So we have a few issues there, but as you can see in our mission statement, that we try to recognize this, but also get our kids to be self-sufficient, contributing members of society once they complete their education, and to have opportunities once they're done. So really, our district is spread out from Clutwan to the north, about 25 miles or so north of Haines on the highway. The only way to get to Clutwan is by the road. If you're coming in, you could take the ferry from Juneau, or you could fly into Haines and then drive up to Clutwan. It is a Chilkat Indian Village tribal community. It's very small. And then our other community in the northern part of our district is Gustavus, near Glacier Bay National Park. The other two schools are further south along Chatham Strait. Angoon is another Tlingit Indian community, and roughly 500 people or so at the present time. And then across from the strait from Angoon is Tenneke Springs, and Tenneke is a very small community, has 10 kids right now. So those make up our four communities. You have to get to them differently in each place. Gustavus has a major runway, and during the summer they have a weekly Alaska Airlines flight that comes in, but otherwise you fly in, and then this past year they got the Marine Ferry service, so that's a way to get there. Tenneke Springs and Angoon are only reachable by seaplanes or by the ferry system, which goes regular once a week type of a service. All of the schools are K-12 schools. Tenneke has one teacher. Clutwan has two. In Gustavus, there are four teachers, and in Angoon, there's about seven. There are two separate buildings in Angoon, an elementary and a high school, middle school building combined. They all have gyms, although the Tanaki Springs gym is built into the school, so it's not a full-size gym like you might think of typically. They're all Title I schools. Angoon is a school-wide Title I. The other three schools are targeted assistance, which means we just give our assistance through No Child Left Behind and Title I services to those kids who qualify. So the next one, our next page, we rely on largely three different federal revenue, or not all federal, two federal revenue sources for funding impact aid. We get impact aid for Angoon, non-taxable land. We get federal impact aid from Gustavus because some of the kids come from families that either live on the national park or work, their parents work there. And then, of course, the same thing would be true for the Kwakwan community where there's non-taxable tribal land there. Due to the small size of our district and the relatively limited funding that we receive from forestry receipts, foundation payments from the state, and impact aid, we contract for services like maintenance, planning and logistics, our payroll, our financial accounting, and technology management, all of that through a resource center here in Juneau. Our CIP application process is something we also contract for, and in our case, it would be cost prohibitive to have employment for individuals and the benefits to do that, so we have to contract for that. It's a challenge because, unlike many districts where you just walk down the hall and you talk to your finance director, we have to use the phone, and sometimes they're not in, or maybe they're doing something else. In the past couple of years, we've been able to add some pretty good innovative instructional technologies using iPads, document cameras, more laptops with some of our kids, and the applications that are being developed are just enormous for kids, and we've got that going down to our kindergarten kids in some classrooms, but it's very nice. Our CIP efforts are largely focused of late on both Kwakwan, that's kind of an extreme picture once you get to it, where we're trying to get that building addressed to meet current standards. It's been 25 years or more since it was built, and a contractor actually hit the side of the building and didn't want to fess up to breaking all those windows, but we got them repaired. A contractor went in with a great big backhoe, and the part of it hit the side of the building and broke that, so we ended up fixing that ourselves. Our CIP efforts are to build or bring Kwakwan back up to current specs. It's got some pretty severe leaking roof problems and other issues with heating and controls that are old. Gustavus just completed its phase three renovation, so it's in good shape. Angoon's in pretty good shape. We've got some heating control issues there too. Tanaki Springs has a composite tile roof and it's leaking in numerous places, and we don't seem to be able to get up on the list high enough to get those addressed. Our class sizes for the most part are pretty small, and so we're able to give some direct one-on-one attention to kids using some of the technologies I described. We are able to have some extracurricular activities for students in Angoon and in Gustavus, more so in Angoon, which has been a larger school up until recently, so that the students were able to travel and participate in things like cross-country track, volleyball, mixed six volleyball, basketball, and the like. Only two of our schools are able to have national school lunch programs. Angoon's had one for quite a few years. Tanaki Springs, even as small as it is, started their national school lunch program 2 years ago. They serve a really great menu to the kids. There's a lot of products that are provided within the community, meeting the guidelines that are necessary to do so. But the community very much appreciates that. We've had to do some upgrades in terms of the equipment and food preparation, things that are needed there. Klukwan, to give you an idea, is very small. There's about 15 kids there currently. Only six of them are from Klukwan. Nine come from Haines area, and they choose to go to Klukwan. So we provide a bus for that, but the school board provides the bus. So we cannot get reimbursed through the transportation arm of that because you can't transport and get funded from the state for traveling or bringing kids from district to district. So that's a school board effort, and the community does not want to see that go away because they're afraid their school might not survive in terms of the numbers, so we do that. In our general fund, as I mentioned, the federal forestry receipts program accounts for about 10% of our general fund. Last year we had 15 students graduate. Most of those were from Angoon. We had a single student from Klukwan and Tenekee Springs, and a couple more from Gustavus. In the bottom picture there, you'll see something we're very proud of. We just finished that this year. That's a new playground in Angoon. They've never had one before. That was provided through a legislative grant, Senator Kukesh. Fortunately, got the governor to say, we'll let you have that. So the principal and I put that together with a couple of help from a couple of members of the Angoon community. But it's very unique for us. Those are our graduation requirements. We've got our, we just changed those a year ago, and they meet the requirements that the state has. Those are some of our standards-based assessment results from last year. Gustavus traditionally does quite well academically. Ironically, they did not make AYP the year before, but only because the participation rate was one student below what they needed to meet 95% or better. Angoon made AYP for the 2 years prior to last year, and then last year our scores dropped enough in math to not qualify. But as you see, the percentages there, the reason for making AYP was through the safe harbor provision, where you improve by 10% or more in your different categories. But we slipped a little in math, so we didn't make it. Klukwan and Tenekee Springs also traditionally make AYP. We don't generally put the scores up for Tenekee because it's so small, it pretty much zeroes in on exactly who those kids might be, or the community members would know who they are. So if you don't make it, that people kind of want that protected, but if you do, they're fine with it. And then the demographics of our district are shown up there. We are majority of our students are Alaska Native Tlingits in both Angoon and Klukwan, and then Tenekee Springs and Gustavus are, there's very little diversity there, but that's our composition. And then you can see our percents for being economically disadvantaged and also those with disabilities, which is about normal for most districts. This is our enrollment. You can see from FY 2005 how the district overall has declined in enrollment, so that currently we have about 153 students as of the count date at the end of October. Our enrollment is hopefully going to flatline a little bit and stay steady. When you lose enrollment, of course, you lose funding, and that makes it difficult to continue to offer the programs that you have. So, and then finally, I talked a little bit about our AYP status. For the most part, the district has done relatively well given our issues, and we are in the process of going through an adoption and acquisition for new reading materials, and then redoing our reading and English language arts curriculum material for compliance with the state, attending some training for that. I don't know that we've done an adoption for quite a while, and in fact we were more site-based managed, meaning that each school could kind of do what it wanted, but today that's pretty hard for us to continue, so we're more district focused in terms of reviewing our curriculum and buying a particular curriculum material, like say a publisher from one place, rather than buying separately for all of them. So with that kind of gives you a snapshot of our district and how the different sites are uniquely different from each other, and some of the challenges we face are part of it. I know that the board would like us to build a better sense of cohesiveness, which we're trying to do, and then last year we also bought something kind of unique for us and might be the first district in the state to do so. We bought a video teleconference equipment through a joint venture with Alaska Communications and Polycom, so that we have 70-inch screens in our four schools and we can actually see and talk and interact with each other. So if we've got district-wide meetings, people can see each other, which has not been possible before. We did have a system before, but it constantly went down, so it didn't work as well. So that's nice to have.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of your communities, I've only been to one, and that's the school in Klukwan, and was able to spend a day there and talk to a lot of the different people in the community, elders and students and faculty, and was really impressed with the effort that was being put into creating both the possibilities for people from outside of the community to learn about Klukwan and the history and the prehistory and the richness of the culture, but also having the really returning to the language more. And I'm wondering if, in fact, that continues the effort of the elders, for instance, to work in the school and bring the cultural pieces into the school.
Representative, to a degree, that's still true. The elders are welcome in our school, and they do come and talk to the kids frequently. They have different opportunities to do cultural events, to teach kids. As you probably know, the Klukwan community and the Chilkat Indian Village has a new tribal center, and they've got some fantastic things there that they invite people to. They try to market themselves in a way that doesn't demean their culture at all, but enhances it and lets people from all over come and visit and learn, and so that's brought into the classrooms. The language is something that they try to teach, but on a limited basis. There's, of course, the requirements if you're going to make it a credit class of certification or endorsement for the language teachers.
Thank you. One thing, as I went through the slide, the highlight that you didn't mention was the fact that you had 15 graduates and no dropouts. I'll mention that because you did.
Yeah, we did. That was something we were happy about. We didn't have any dropouts. We had some students that did not graduate out of that class of seniors, either because they didn't pass a portion of the HSGQE or something of that nature, but they didn't drop out. And some of them come back and try to pass the HSGQE later, which they still can do. So, and we had a student last year who came back and did that from the year before, and then got their diploma.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. First one is, you show the demographics where basically you're looking at a steady decline in your district population. Any particular reasons stand out why folks are leaving?
Well, Angoon has probably lost the most students over the period of time. There's little economic opportunity in the community of Angoon. Commercial fishing is almost non-existent there anymore, and so it's extremely difficult for anybody to get a job and make a living. The school is the largest employer. You've got city government, you've got the post office, you've got one store, somebody that works for the Alaska seaplanes that fly in and out. So beyond that, there's almost no opportunity for employment. And so that has much to do with it. If you're not retired, collecting Social Security or maybe government assistance, then how else do you make it? So even though the number of buildings in the community is pretty static, the enrollment has dropped dramatically in the last few years.
Okay. And then the second question. On one of your slides, you basically highlighted the difference in parental involvement amongst the communities in your district. And I believe it said basically no, there's no parental support for the kids in Angoon.
I wouldn't say there's no support, for very little.
Okay. Any reasons for that? Or?
Well, I think that people entrust the school to do the job for their kids. And as much as we try, as many schools do, to encourage them to come to the school to participate in events, we just get a very, very low turnout. You almost need to entice people through food, meals, that sort of thing, or reach out to them individually and call them up, and that's for every single thing where you would like parents to come. In Klukwan, which is also a Native village, they are very much more involved than Angoon is, and they're, so you've got some cultural similarities, but yet a difference in terms of participation on the part of the parents in the community. If there's an issue that people are upset about, they'll be there, and just like you might imagine anywhere. But in Gustavus, we have a fantastic parent and community support for that school, not just in person, but also financially for student activities. Tenneke has good parent support, very little support financially, just because there's not much there to be able to contribute to help kids out, so they rely more on the district resources to send kids to activities like Whale Fest in Sitka or something like that. But
okay, Representative Kawasaki, then Representative Sisna.
Thanks. Today we're going to have a briefing, I think, from about the performance scholarship, and I'm just curious if your students in your district were able to take advantage of the performance scholarship. If not, are there problems with it from your point of view?
Well, last year we did not have any students that took advantage of that, even though we had 15 graduates. There's I gave a report to Commissioner Hanley on our district's status relative to the performance scholarship. And we had one student whose parents could afford paying for their son's schooling, and so they just did it. We had another student who went to school at UAS, and the principal let them know about the performance scholarship, but they didn't apply. We had another student from Tenneke that went out of state. And then the others, most of the 15 graduates were from Angoon, and only one went to University of Alaska College, and I don't know why she didn't apply, but she didn't. The others didn't go to any post-secondary schooling opportunities.
I guess just to follow up, did the students have the ability to take the courses necessary to comply with the Alaska Performance Scholarship?
Well, if we don't offer the class directly through our secondary teachers, we have the opportunity, like most people in Alaska, most schools, to give them distance classes. And so, for example, this year we have a number of students in Angoon that took Spanish online through the ACLIN program, which our district was the original grantee for. And so I know that I'm still the chair of the ACLIN committee and Alaska Learning Network. So we have students who take classes through ACLIN from Tenneke. Most of the distance courses that secondary students take used to come from Gustavus and Klukwan, and some from Tenneke, but Tenneke is limited. They only have a few students who are secondary grade levels. My opinion is that as the performance scholarship gets more rigorous in terms of the courses you have to take, the grade point that you have to have, and the scores that are required through the standardized tests, for the admission tests like the ACT or the SAT, the more it's going to mirror the top of your student abilities anyway. And while I think it's great that they can go to school in Alaska and get a good scholarship, those students in many cases would probably qualify for scholarships regardless of the APS. So, and for students like the ones that we typically see in Angoon, they probably won't qualify academically for it as the standards get raised. Mm-hmm. So they won't even be able to.
We're really pressed for time today. One more question, Representative Sisna.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, In what sounded like a community that has some real challenges in Angoon, that was originally a fishing village, right? That was the place.
Yes, it was. It had a long history of fisheries as a resource for people in the community, and they were quite a few licenses there. I don't think there's more than one or two licenses. I'm not even sure that they're still fishing commercially, but I forgot to mention there is a sport fishing lodge in the community, and they employ a number of people seasonally for being guides and working in the lodge, that sort of thing. But that's, like I said, seasonal. But there's no commercial fishery that I know of really existing anymore.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask, is limited entry, and this goes way into the back in the past, a past that actually I was around here at that point. Did that have any effect, you know, on the community? Because in some of the southeastern communities I've talked to, the fact that the right to fish in many places went with the permit that was given and the limited entry. And so the community kind of eventually lost out on the ability to fish in their own area.
I'm not real familiar with that past history, so I can't really speak directly to it. I know that people regret not being able to make a living that way, but the costs are so prohibitive in terms of living there. We had, just as a simple example, we tried to move some of our perishables like paints and chemicals and whatever into a Connex building. We insulated it and put a baseboard electric heater in the bottom, and for 1 month the bill was $1,200 just for the electricity. And so some of the families pay such high prices for electricity because it's a generator-driven electrical system within the community that it's hard to make it. And if you've got any kind of business, you've got to absorb those costs as overhead before you make any kind of profit or living.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Wish we had more time. We always wish you had more time. Nita and Yayu. I've been talking to my staff recently about we've got to get a hold of the Alaskan Native Educators Association. We as a committee need to know who they are, where they are, and what they're doing. And so I called Anita Reardon yesterday and said, Anita, do you think you can come to Juneau and testify before the committee? And Anita said, I am in Juneau. So I give them 10 minutes. We need to know who they are, what they do, and in 10 minutes, please, for the record, introduce yourself and tell us what the Native Educators Association does.
E. Koyana. 10 minutes. I've never spoken in Yupik in 10 minutes. But I will. Kwaka huina atka yuchulo kwani anga yukam nikwani igwamuk. I yugi san rilhamuklu. Maurlukalu nanikuk soram anglitzulo yuchtun ki toatlu achwindlgen school atlumni bia eighteen tamani. Хинтик юут кэлхулла юртлхуллаа хуули миллуанун атгалу юрлек.
I was raised by my parents, late Frederick and Pauline Prince of Katlik, Alaska. I was mostly raised by my grandmother, Teresa and Stefan Kamarov, who raised me until I was 6 in my language, until they gave me to the Western education. My name is Nita Reardon. I was born and raised in Catholic. I am an educator, and having come from a large family, being the oldest daughter, I've been an educator all my life. I've taught 28 years within the state, Bethel and Kotzebue. I'm still an educator. Even if I'm retired, I still care for our students who are from all over the state, and because of that, and believing in them, I represent Alaska Native Educators Association, which is a statewide, and we serve all of the other associations throughout the state from south, west, east, and west. So the mission statement that we developed before our association speaks to the years of what I lived, the years of my work, and having that experiences from a BIA school to the state school, and the times that I have taught in rural Alaska. Listen carefully. Our mission statement for Alaska Educator Association, we believe in it. We live by it, and we practice it. To enhance, promote, and advocate for all Alaska Native cultures, values, languages, and traditions in the educational entities throughout Alaska. That's who I represent mostly. Thank you.
Oyana. Yayuk, for the record.
Ayayurunga, Sapnazomi Itunga, Darlum, Anian Lut Panigianga, Suksham Tutigianga, Uriva Mutin in Pira Radunga. Good morning. My name is Yayuk Ininipiak. My English name is Bernadette Albano Simple. I know it's the longest name, that's why I use Yayuk. I was born and raised in Nome, Alaska, and I didn't speak a word of English until I went to school at age 5 as a kindergartner. And I'm sure when the teacher called for Bernadette, there was no response. And then I've been an educator for about 23 years at Nome Public Schools with different jobs. I started out teaching Inupiaq language and culture, and then I got into English as a second language because I knew eventually in 20 years Inupiaq would be taught as a second language to our wee little ones. And then I've been in a regular classroom and teaching fourth and fifth grade, sixth grade, intermediate grades. And the Alaska Native Education Association stems from the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative, a project that was headed by Oscar Quigley and Ray Barnhart and Alec, I forgot the third person.
Dorothy Larson.
Oh, and then, mm-hmm.
And we have our board members from Kodiak, Barrow, Dillingham, Bethel area, and myself in Nome and Interior, Fairbanks areas. And this, until we can meet face-to-face, which is kind of rare, because we piggyback with other organizations and conferences, then we will do our voting. But I'm interim co-chair with another person from the Interior. We've been involved in various projects, and we partnered with the Alaska Educators of Alaska. I mean, I'm sorry, the Future Educators of Alaska and Alaska Native Teacher Preparation Program. And we've been involved with writing resolutions with AFN on behalf of Alaska Native students. We give presentations where Native education is involved like the FEA conference and the Bilingual Multicultural Education and Equity Conference.
I wish we had more time. I wish we had time for questions, but at least we have. Maybe we can get you by phone sometime down the road. Okay?
Thank you.
And I would like to say the Native Educators, so I've known these ladies for decades. And I mean, we have people with master's degrees and even doctorate degrees within that organization. They're highly skilled. I believe many of the questions that we're asking here in Juneau, they have the answers. So hopefully we'll be able to call on you more often.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll next take up the legal issue of HB 256, the repeal intervention in schools, as the bill is currently written. I know my colleague, Representative Seaton, wants to be certain everybody understands the bill as it's written. The bill is a starting point, definitely not a finishing point for the discussion about intervention. And I look forward to hearing the Department of Law and our own ledge legal for questions. Neil Slotnick, for the record, sir, please introduce yourself and present your testimony. And excuse me, committee members, we do have the excerpts from the Moore case in your packet, and that Neil wanted us to pay attention to, and if we have questions, we'll take them as we go. Sir.
Thank you, Chair Dick. My name is Neil Slotnick. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I've represented the Department of Education and Early Development for the past 10 years, and I was the chief counsel in the case of Moore v. State. And thank you, Chair Dick, for this opportunity to testify about the legal concerns that we see with HB 256. Now, there's three concerns that I want to raise for you, and they're as follows. First, we're concerned that HB 256 creates uncertainty. Of course, uncertainty can always lead to more litigation, and that uncertainty has to do with the department's authority. And second, we're concerned that HB 256 could have unintended consequences. And third, we have a concern that HB 256 could leave a void in this legislature's response to ensuring that children receive their right to an education that's guaranteed to them under the Education Clause. Now, as background, the legal basis of all analysis really is the Education Clause of the Alaska Constitution. That's Article 7, Section 1. And the Alaska Supreme Court has told us that children have a constitutional right to an education. Now, one element, of course, of that constitutional right is accountability. What we have in Alaska is we deliver that constitutional right through a system of local control, local school districts. But the state is required to have an accountability system in place. That's required both by federal law, by state law. AS 1407-123 requires the state have an accountability system. And the Superior Court in the Moore case also told us that it's an element of the constitutional right of education, is that there be an accountability system. Now, given that we have local control of education, and then we have accountability, that creates an obvious tension between state accountability and local control. And before 2008, the authority of the Department of Education to exercise accountability was fuzzy. That authority was implied through federal law, but that wasn't a direct grant of authority. It was a fuzzy, it was not explicit. Then in 2008, the legislature adopted SB 285, which made it explicit. The department had authority to intervene in school districts, but at the same time, the legislature put limitations on the department's authority. Under SB 285, the department could only intervene for purposes of improving instruction, and the department had to have exit strategies. It had to have petition processes. And what this led to is this led to a great deal of clarity. It was now very clear what the scope of department authority was, and that actually reduced that tension where we didn't know for sure what we could exercise under federal law. Now, of course, what HB 256 does is it repeals SB 285, and it removes that explicit authority of the department to intervene in a school district and to redirect funding, and it also removes those sideboards, those restrictions the legislature had put on the department's authority. So this creates uncertainty. It's now no longer as clear how the department should react when it's in implementing the accountability system that state law requires. And we can argue that there's authority to intervene, and we can get there through federal law, because the accountability system tells us we must implement federal law. But there are problems with relying on federal law. Federal law gives the state options for intervening. There's a menu. There's a list of interventions that the state can take. But it doesn't get explicit authority for any one of those. And anytime the legislature takes an action, courts are going to say to us, look, there had to be a purpose for that action. That has to have meaning. Right now, under the SB 285 that was adopted in 2008, the department has explicit authority to redirect funds if the department makes a finding that doing so would improve the instruction that's offered in the district. So now if we repeal the explicit authority to redirect funds, we can go to federal law, and federal law says, well, redirecting funds is one of the things that the department can do in implementing an accountability system. But it's not required, and so the court's going to look at it and say, well, the legislature just took away your authority to redirect funds. You're saying federal law gives you that authority. How's the court going to resolve that? We don't know. That's my testimony, is that it leads to uncertainty, and uncertainty is not good for education. It often leads to litigation. could get, if we take an intervention, if the department takes an intervention, it could get sued by a district that says, well, you don't have that authority. If the department doesn't take an intervention, it could get sued by a child who is saying, you must take action to protect my constitutional right to an education. Another thing about uncertainty is that let me put it in the positive. One aspect of certainty and clarity in the mix of control of an authority between local districts and the department is that that can increase the cooperation and collaboration between school districts and the department. And I can give you some examples of that. After SB 285 was adopted, and the department was preparing for an intervention in a school district, and that would be Southwest Regional School District. The district came forward, and the district said, the district didn't want to have an intervention. And the district said, on its own, it took the initiative to adopt the school reform measures that the department was pursuing. And that actually, that collaboration and that cooperative model that was followed in Southwest Regional School District has been very effective. And it's been followed in other districts since. And in fact, since the passage of SB 285, the department has not intervened in one single school district. Since the passage of SB 285, the department has not redirected the funding in any single school district, including those that were already under intervention. And finally, we were able to settle the Moore lawsuit by reaching an agreement that promotes a collaborative approach to school reform. So that's the limit of my testimony here. I'm not saying that it does away with the authority. I'm only saying it creates uncertainty. Let me move to my next point, which was very similar to the point that was raised by Representative Seaton in the hearing on Wednesday, and that's whether HB 256 actually leads to an unintended consequence. Remember, I just said that now if we still have an authority to intervene, we've got to find it through federal law. And federal law is, as I've said, much broader, and it's based really on low test scores, and it gives us authority to intervene based on low test scores. What SB 285 did is it said, intervene only when you see instructional practices and only when you see evidence that those instructional practices could be improved by an intervention. Much more limited. That was the direction that this legislature gave us. Much better direction, as I've said, for education, for the department, for the school districts, than what we get through federal law. Now, my third point that I want to make about HB 256 is that there's a possibility that with HB 256, the legislature could find itself in a situation where we're not complying with our constitutional requirement as it was laid out under the Moore case. And let me explain that. What we were told in the Moore case is that the state must exercise accountability when it has evidence of chronic low performance, and that the state must take a more directive role and a more assistive role in those school districts where scores are chronically low. And what the court did is, and we presented to the court, we said, but Your Honor, we already have an accountability system. We already have ability to intervene. In fact, we already did have one intervention in a school district. And she looked at the scores, and she looked at the scores of some of these districts. She saw how low they were. And she said, this has got to stop. You can't just depend on local control for delivery of education. It's a state responsibility, and in many districts it works just great, and the state doesn't have to have a system of, it doesn't have to have an intervention. But in those districts where there's evidence of chronic low performance, there must be a legislative response to that. She didn't tell us what it had to be, but she told us there must be a legislative response.
And the legislative response was SB 285. Now, my concern would be this: if the legislature chooses to repeal SB 285 and repeal the explicit authority of the department to intervene for purposes of correcting instructional practices, if you repeal that and you don't take some other measure at the same time, then I would advise that there's a risk that you're out of compliance with the Superior Court's decision in the Moore case. And it's true, the Moore case has been settled, and so perhaps it's not binding on us, but the obligation under the Education Clause to provide an education to children is still with us. And let me put it perhaps another way here to make sure that I want to make sure that everybody understands that my advice is very limited. If this body is holding the Department of Education accountable, that is absolutely appropriate. That is absolutely something that this legislature should do. You need to hold the Department of Education accountable for its oversight. But the court also told us we need to hold the local school districts accountable. That's a legislative duty under the Education Clause. And right now, in the face of low scores, we need to have a system for holding those local districts accountable. What the legislature did in 2008 in response to the Superior Court was it adopted SB 285. It said, that's our response. That's how we're going to hold the local school districts accountable. And if we repeal SB 285, then what is there? That's the question that I'm asking. Is there a void? Is there a legal obligation that we're no longer meeting? So that's the question I raise. I don't have the answer for you, but these are legal concerns that it's my job to bring to your attention.
Representative Sisman?
Thank you very much. I woke up thinking about this whole issue. So you know how that is. Kind of takes over. And the thing I kept on thinking, and I don't know that your role is pivotal in this, but it is in one sense. Education in the state of Alaska has been dependent for a very long time on the federal government. And when we're talking about creating the kind of school system that we do have, and it's really very Western, there's been efforts to try to make it more locally based, but at the same time, it still has huge federal and sort of Western cultural rules in it. Is it not true that, and you may not know the answer to this, but that if in fact suits might be an issue, but the lack of funding might happen if in fact rules are not followed here with the present administration running the school programs, don't follow the requirements that really the intervention districts really are failing on. Does anybody know that? Do you know that?
Through the chair, Representative of CISNA, if you're speaking of federal funding and the possibility mm-hmm. that we could lose some of our federal funding, mm-hmm. that is correct. That can happen if the federal government were to find us out of compliance. We could be put on a plan of correction. There could be, ultimately, it could resolve in a way that we lose federal funding. Mm-hmm. We would, of course, resist that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, I'm losing my voice here. The question that I have is that we have a huge, diverse state with very different goals in communities for the purpose of education. And absent the requirement that the legislature put on that no one can graduate high school without passing the high school graduating qualifying exam, if that was not there, would the state have more ability to integrate flexible standard community standards for education? For instance, we're trying to make education relevant to students, project-based education and other things, and yet everything comes back to our legislative requirement that nobody can graduate or be successful as a student leaving high school unless they pass that one standardized test across the state. So I'm trying to figure out legally how much is being driven by the tests that we've mandated for graduation, and not meaning to diminish education, but to make it more relevant to different communities and different community goals and standards. Is the high school qualifying exam, is that the underpinning criteria that is restricting us to not take the individual community goals and standards in place?
Through the chair, Representative Sita, I would answer your question, no. It's not the HSGQE. I'm not sure that there is anything that restricts communities and school districts from providing the type of enriched and locally oriented approach to education that you're advocating. My understanding, and I am not an educator, is that we can do that, and we can still also prepare children to pass the high school qualifying exam and to meet standards for proficiency in reading, writing, and math. And the reason I answered your question no, however, is that in the Moore case, the judge was very clear that the state has an obligation to prepare children to meet those minimal standards in reading, writing, and math, the constitutional standards, the standards that in fact are adopted by the state board and this legislature. We have an obligation to offer that opportunity to learn and to be proficient in those standards. And it comes not from this legislature's requirement that you pass an HS qualifying exam. It comes from the Constitution originally. So there's always that backdrop. We need to offer students the skills they need to be successful in society.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have to have some level of performance that comes out of our schools. We have to have a way to measure that. So test scores or testing, and thus the scores become the measure of that level of performance and whether the teachers are imparting the appropriate level and quality of knowledge to the students. And I don't know of any other way to measure the effectiveness of the educational system. Certainly open to suggestions. But if test scores are low in a particular district, there can be many reasons. Just five of them. We could have poor teachers. We could have a poor curriculum. The students themselves could simply be on the lower end of the bell curve. The parents could simply not be providing any support. Or the facilities may be in such terrible shape that the facilities themselves are just a distraction to the teaching environment. A couple of those things we can affect by what we do, statutes and money. We can direct where money goes. We can direct write statutes that sort of guide folks into particular curriculums or particular standards for teachers and all that. The whole intervention process that was, as you say, in 285 was basically the legislature directing the department to intervene specifically in teaching methods and curriculum, if I understood you correctly. addresses those items, but it can't address, by statute, can't address some of the other issues. And the fact that intervention, certainly in the UPIT school district, has not succeeded in raising the level of performance. It has worked in other school districts, and other school districts have gone intervention and since come out. So instead of, as 256 here, instead of basically eliminating 285, are there some things legally that we can look at in the legislature to add to our level of intervention? Is that the solution? Granted, I don't want to, you know, it's never a good management principle to try to micromanage your people. You give them the mission and you let them, based on their higher qualified people, they should be able to accomplish the mission. But is there something more we can do legally under the existing statutes, add to the existing statutes to enhance our ability to intervene specifically in other things besides curriculum and teaching methods?
Through the chair, Representative Feige. I'm probably going to duck this question. I'm going to answer it. Yes, you have that authority to do that.
And I realize you're a lawyer and not an educator.
Exactly. So I'm not going to give you a list or recommendation or suggestion as to what action this body can take. From the Department of Law's perspective, the fact that we have this committee looking into this issue and taking this very seriously and being concerned about the low test scores, the low performance, the interventions. From the Department of Law's perspective, that is evidence that the legislature is complying with its constitutional responsibility. But I'm not going in a position to make a recommendation to you on how.
Representative Feige, Jim Michelle is here in the room. Perhaps we could finish the questions of Neil, and then we could Jim Michelle could come and answer that for us. So if we could hold, just pause on for waiting for the answer on that. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It looks like to me, having read the little snippets from the Moore case, that bottom line is, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, the people of the state should be looking at us legislators, not the Department of Education, not the school districts, but us, because we are the ones that are held responsible, according to the court. It says, which places the responsibility to maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state squarely upon the legislature. To date, the state has not demonstrated that the delegation of this responsibility to school districts through local control have been identified as chronically underperforming, but which do not appear to have been accorded adequate assistance and oversight will result in compliance with this constitutional responsibility. So to me, that says that we, as legislators, and in this specific committee, we have the responsibility to look at what we've been doing and see what needs to be changed. Now, we found out from the exit exam that there's been a problem. But I feel that right now, and I think it's something we need to look at, it's way too late by the if we give it in high school. Most of it is based on eighth grade information, so we should be giving it at the end of eighth grade, not in high school. So, I mean, I there's some of the things that we are doing maybe that we just need to change the focus and see if we're doing it correctly and see if there's other things that can be doing. And we as a committee, that's our responsibility. And I think that maybe we do need to look at some of this. I personally don't feel like it's getting rid of the Senate bill. But to reevaluate at this time in our heritage, or whatever you want to call it, that we need to step back, do some reevaluating, and then make some changes.
Thank you. I waited till the end, hoping somebody else would make my point. And thank you, Representative Wilson. Because as I, Neil, as I read through this, of course, it's very plain. It's the job of the legislature. By constitution, it's our job, responsibility to establish and maintain a educational system. That's one of our main functions. What we have is underperforming school districts and an overperforming department. And that's with you know, this SB 285, the hope was that we could have, you know, the collaboration and cooperation ending up with a good final product. But as one of my staffers mentioned, what we asked for was cooperation, and what we ended up with was collaboration. And I think there was an unintended consequence here that while the request, again, was for cooperation, that the actual outcome, and we heard testimony from Upiat School District, who we will hear from other school districts, that there wasn't a positive outcome for that. So we're definitely not trying to create a void here. We desperately want to create a good, healthy system. But we have the, as Representative Wilson said, we have the ultimate responsibility. Us here and you know, in the House, in the Senate, it's our responsibility to make sure it happens well. I don't think SB 285, the product of that, was not healthy. Again, I'll repeat myself. There was I encountered a superintendent quite recently who said, we've got to get an exemption to NCLB. I said, why? You know, it doesn't mean anything. It's a meaningless metric. He said yes, but we're all going to be in intervention soon, and the department's going to mess with our finances. I mean, this is one of the best superintendents in the state that is terribly concerned that because of this impossible standard that the department will come in. So that I can create that image for the department. Department, by whatever means, before my time, seemed to create that. I believe Commissioner Hanley, I believe he's got all the skills necessary to resolve this. But my concern isn't for just now here and today. My concern is that we create a system by which it doesn't matter who the commissioner is, that we will, that the school district out there, they will get the services they need. The legislature will step up to the table and provide the educational system that's needed, and that we don't have the wounding that's been going on for past X number of years. So thank you, Representative Wilson, for making the point. And Neil, I do recognize there is a legislative responsibility here. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Thank you. Again, on page one in your quotes, the very bottom one, on page 100 through 101, the last part of the sentence there, the opportunity to acquire the basic tools they need to succeed in both traditional and global societies. It seems that the only measurement that we've got that we are impressing is global society. We are not measuring, we're not requiring that people are able to work in traditional societies. If that's a focus, it's ignored in our testing regime. So I guess my question is, if the judge has said both of these missions are there and we basically totally ignore one of them at the extreme concentration on the other, does that put us in jeopardy of not fulfilling what the judge is saying that we're directed to do for both societies? And following that, is there any ability for the local disparate communities to have any influence on which of those two is more preponderantly focused upon?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, there is room for local control of education. There is room for local setting of priorities. There is, all of that room is there, and I believe many of our school districts, you're going to find examples of that. If you go to St. Mary's, if you go to Lower Yukon, you go to Lower Kuskokwim, you're going to see that there are local priorities being implemented. But if you read all of the quotes that I've assembled here, or I've got the entire decision here also, you're going to see that Judge Gleason was very clear. We have to teach our kids those skills in reading, writing, and math. We cannot do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Jean Michelle, if you wouldn't mind to come join us here, and if you could respond to Representative Puggy's question. It's good to see you in person there. It's,
yeah, here I am. This is my
just
voice.
Just a disembodied voice.
Familiar. I like to multitask. I'm Jean Michelle with the Legislative Legal Services. And hello to all of you. Good morning. I would like to respond, but initially I'd like to say that I don't disagree with much of what Neil Slotnick has advised you this morning, with the exception of the statement that federal law is their only guidance for intervention if you repeal former SB 285. We have already in our state laws an accountability system. We have some reward provisions that are anticipated by the federal law. We have in the form of grants, school improvement grants. We have general supervisory authority that we've given to the Department of Education over all aspects of the education system. We have in the past, as under Title 14, the legislature has delegated functions both to the department and to the local school boards, and I'm sure you're all fairly familiar with that, how that system works currently. And when the Moore decision came out, which currently is we're reacting to, but technically doesn't serve as precedent yet, since it's a trial court decision. But it's instructive in the sense that that judge did look at, I believe it was a four-week trial, a lot of the evidence that school districts and the state presented at the time about how those two delegations were working together, the delegated authorities. When the Judge Gleason said in 2007 that the responsibility is squarely on the legislature, the way I interpret that, because the legislature has limited powers, as you all know, we share state authority with the executive and the judicial branches of government. If you continue to read that quote, Judge Gleason's concern was primarily with our decentralized system of education, and that it may not be working for some districts that lack the resources or the expertise to improve their schools after a demonstration of some time. It was the subject of that litigation. We operated until 2008 under our current state laws. The NCLB Act was passed in 2001, and in my opinion, the legislature has in the past given quite a bit of direction on how to improve schools, but what may be lacking is the coordination of those provisions. There's a school about accountability system. I mean, after the initial delegation to the state executive function, the department and the state school board, we spelled out how local school boards are formed, who sits on those boards, and what kind of authority they had. We can't, as a legislative body, start hiring and firing local school board employees or state employees, but we can direct the level of expertise that these departments and school boards need, or the kinds of people that they hire as consultants, as long as we provide some money attached to that or reconcile that with our school funding. So in response to Representative Feige's question, there are, these present a lot of policy calls on the part of the legislature. And the first question would be, should the delegation of the responsibility continue to be set up the way it is now, the division of authority? And in the past, the Alaska Supreme Court has said, good idea. We have very disparate kinds of school districts. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach that works in this state, and that's okay as long as everybody is afforded an adequate education, however that's defined. And we have relied heavily on the local school districts to help us out with that. When that fails, though, state has to intervene, and that's probably a term of art at this point under the Federal Act. But I would argue that all of the oversight authority we've given to the state board and the department in the way, in the form of an accountability system, the department withhold state funds if there is a lack of compliance by the local school district with the current state laws. There is the ability for the state board to close schools, to take over schools, to provide experts to help and technical assistance to help the local school districts. That all predated SB 285. And the history of the school system was to, it originally started out as a state-operated school system, but over time, more and more authority was delegated to the local school districts, and maybe in some communities that's not working as well as others. But the legislature could rethink that delegation and the division of functions. The legislature could also obviously provide additional targeted grant funds. If you look, I don't know if all of you have access to the consent decree in the Moore case, but that's, in my opinion, provides a good starting point if the legislature is inclined to start restructuring the school system, particularly in the rural areas. The settlement agreement came, at least in part, from those local school districts. They were asking for these interventions. So as a state, as a legislature with constitutional authority to provide by general law the state system, you could look at that consent decree and say, maybe this is what we need in all rural school districts. Maybe these ideas should be statewide. And one of the main components or differences in the way the consent decree functions and in the way our current school districts and our authorization to them functions is we don't mandate kindergarten, for example. We don't have a preschool system. We have an approval for preschools, but it's fairly, we haven't given a lot of guidance about what kind of preschools or pre-K should be approved in the state. We haven't funded except on a pilot, in some pilot projects, that level of education. Those are legislative options. Those are policy calls. The consent decree also calls for some targeted grant funds to help with school improvement, to specifically pay for teacher development and training for some cultural programs before they're put into the classroom. There's a 4-week training provision required. There's an oversight advisory body. So really the options are pretty wide open in terms of comparing what we've done in the past in our legislative role, which is basically to provide guidance through state law, and to provide funding to direct some of those activities. So we could certainly get more specific. That's what I heard Neil say, that SB 285 gave them a little more specificity about which intervention approaches to take. Maybe there was too much emphasis at the time on redirecting funding, but it, I believe that was in response to needing additional technical assistance on the ground that was going to take some additional resources that we hadn't yet funded. We did that at the same time, though, that SB 288 or 285 passed. We also provided a substantial inflow of money for those five school districts to try to help offset the costs for coaching and other resource needs in those districts. This consent decree goes beyond the five school districts. And as I said earlier, the legislature could devise a more specific system in state law. We don't have to delegate curriculum authority. We don't have to delegate state standards. We can set those in statute. Obviously, you'd have to rely on some expertise in order to do that. That makes the standards less flexible. And so there's a trade-off with that approach.
Thank you. Excuse me, if we could, I'm thinking about people who have flown in to town here and who need to fly, and we do have people that are here all the time. Gene, this is, we're going to call on you again if all you don't mind. Okay. And if we could hold our questions of Gene, who's across the road. If people don't mind, I'm going to change the schedule a little bit. We have Esther Cox here, the chairperson of the Board of Education, and she's flown into town and needs to leave. So if we could get Esther's testimony first. Commissioner Hanley, if you'd like to join her, you're more than welcome to. Anyway, she'll present the annual report. This will be the first annual report following the passage of SB 1 last year. We have a copy of the report in our packet. Chairman Cox.
Thank you very much.
Take your liberty.
Thank you much, very much.
And do identify yourself for the record.
I will. And I assume that the post-secondary report on the APS is coming after this. Is that correct? Okay, with that, so I can leave some of that out of here so you won't have to do it twice. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Esther Cox, and I am the chair of the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. As the chair indicated, I'm here to begin the implementation of SB 1, which was passed last legislative session. In essence, it states the Alaska Board of Education chair will give an annual report to the legislature within the first 30 days of the session. And besides that, I'm always delighted to meet with you people because I look for any opportunity that this board has to communicate with our legislature. A written report has been provided for the committees, and my comments will simply summarize from that report. After the report, I would be happy to answer questions, and in the fact that I could not answer the question, I've got great backup back there with Commissioner Hanley and with Marcy Herman. So a little bit on the Alaska Performance Scholarship. You're going to hear a great report from Diane Behrens. But I want to tell you about the board involvement in some of this. Implementation of this new scholarship has had the attention of the board and the department for several months, but all the attention continues to be worth it for the opportunity it provides for Alaska students. Through regulation, the board established eligibility criteria including GPA, cut scores on the SAT, SAT, and work keys, qualifying courses with a phase-in schedule so all districts would have time to beef up curriculum as well as give scholarship opportunities to students who graduated this past year and for the next 2 years who will not have had the opportunity to access the final credit requirements. And I think in 2014 that then we will be going full bore with all of the requirements for the APS. Access to rigorous courses continues to be a concern of the board, and many students are supplementing their school curriculum with online courses. This opportunity not only provides the rigorous curriculum dictated by the scholarship eligibility, but it provides a strong and positive learning experience for our students. It is encouraging to know that districts as small as Heidelberg, with only 4 graduates, have still been able to provide the necessary courses to qualify, and in fact, does have a student who qualified. The board approved a number of course titles that would fit the APS criteria in December, and as soon as they go through the Department of Law and the Lieutenant Governor review, they will become regulation. The board will continue to monitor and tweak the implementation of the APS as issues or concerns arise. And when you hear the report from post-secondary, I think you'll agree with me that we are certainly going in the right direction. Impressively, the percentage of Alaska grads who took the SAT or ACT grew from 77% in 2010 to an unheard of 85% in 2011. And more good news is that districts are reporting more students enrolled in science and math. So if there's a question in your mind, if you've created a good thing, trust me, you have. Bless you. The board adopted several amendments regarding work keys assessments, which are career-ready tests given to all 11th graders each year. ACT owns work keys, has created thousands of job profiles, which analyze job skills needed for specific jobs. So assessed students are able to compare the skill level with the skill level of those particular jobs. Students with qualifying scores receive national career readiness certificates, and the test may be used to qualify for Alaska Performance Scholarship if the student is going to attend a post-secondary certificate program in Alaska. The board also decided that it was the IEP team of students with significant cognitive disabilities decision if the student should be required to take the work keys assessment. Our board said all 11th graders, and then we gave the right to the IEP team of these particular students to make that final decision. In September, the board put out for public comment the Alaska Supplement for Work Keys Assessment, which clarifies the appropriate use of accommodations for students with disabilities and students with limited proficiency. Final action was taken in January. Of the 9,007 Alaska students who took work keys in 2010-11, 85% or 7,665 earned a National Career Readiness Certificate. Because WIDA, World Class Instructional Design and Assessment, proficiency standards are research-based and of high quality, the board adopted the WIDA standards through English language learners for pre-kindergarten through grade 12. And the board and department do respond to our constituencies when a regulation can be improved upon to lighten the burden of the districts and teachers. The board extended the time for districts to distribute results of the state standards-based assessments, the SBAs, and the high school graduation qualifying exam to teachers, as the previous 20-day deadline was burdensome. The board amended 2 regulations regarding state assessments and adopted revised participation guidelines for students with disabilities. This allowed for response to suggestions from stakeholders, continued to identify new resources, and provided for keeping up to date on practices in accommodations. The board addresses several housekeeping items throughout the course of a year, including clarification the SBA is the assessment for calculating students' participation in adequate yearly progress. And the one assessment that many of you are particularly interested in, I'm sure, is the high school graduation qualifying exam. It truly is a minimum competency test of basic skills. And once students have passed it, they know they can move along in their curriculum. If a student does not pass, then he or she knows what areas must be addressed for additional work. After much deliberation, The board voted to recommend keeping the HSGQE for several reasons. It does give students a baseline and basic skills, and in this day of accountability, it's another information tool that can be used to adjust program and or a student's curriculum map. The bottom line is that it does show that students have demonstrated minimum competencies in essential skills needed to function in our society. In the 2010-11 HSGQE, 83% of grade 10 students passed reading, 71% passed writing, and 69% passed math. Students have further opportunities to pass the exam in grades 11 and 12 and after leaving high school. For the purpose of reporting adequate yearly progress, the board amended regulations to allow districts to include in the limited English proficiency subgroup those students who exited the program in the prior 2 years so districts could have credit for successfully transitioning students out of the program. The board was briefed on school and district adequate yearly progress results at the September meeting. Three changes to the calculations of the 2011 data significantly affected the results. Percentage of students who should be proficient increased from 77% to 82%, language arts, from 66% to 74% in math. And please remember that according to the feds, we will be 100% efficient or proficient by 2014. And ladies and gentlemen, I've been in this business a very long time and I have yet to see 100% of anything. Teacher certification and teacher quality. The board adopted several amendments to regulations pertaining to teacher certification. Briefly, the board required teachers moving from an initial 3-year certificate to a provisional 5-year renewable certificate to have been employed as a teacher for at least 2 years. Those who have not taught for 2 years may apply for another initial certificate. The board felt strongly that no one should hold the state's professional teaching certificate without having worked as a teacher for at least 2 years. Because the state gives teachers an initial period to complete credits before receiving a professional certificate, the board adopted an amendment that will no longer require educators seeking provisional 2-year administrative, special education administrative, or special services certificates to complete 6 semester hours of credit before receiving the certificate. Those credits must be completed, however, before the next stage of certification. The board also acted on the recommendation of the Teacher Quality Working Group, which incidentally is meeting right now in Juneau, and that's an approved subgroup of a lot of people, but approved by the board. Change the name of vocational education to career and technical education. Require districts to make available to the public the blank forms used in teacher and administrative evaluation. Require district employment applications to require teachers to disclose any prior teaching experience in Alaska. The board also approved teacher preparation programs for elementary K-5 math at the University of Alaska Southeast, for an elementary endorsement at Alaska Pacific University, and added an endorsement in career and technical education certificate program at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Alaska's Type N certificate must be initiated by a district who wants to hire an industry professional who has not matriculated through a teacher preparation program. The ASD might want to hire a welder to teach welding, for example. There is a regulation that is now under review by the Department of Law that requires CTE-endorsed Type M teachers to demonstrate competency in reading, writing, and math by passing the Praxis 1 within 1 year of obtaining the certificate and demonstrate instructional skills. In order to renew a Type N limited CTE certificate for 5 years, the local school board must submit on the applicant's behalf a renewal application which contains the evidence of the following: 3 semesters of credit related to the applicant's employment, 135 hours of work experience in the specialty field outside of work with students, a statement of satisfactory teaching performance under the limited certificate. These new regulations apply only to the Type M limited CTE certificate. Teachers in specialty areas of Alaska Native Language or Culture and ROTC are exempt. And the B. For recertification, Type A certificated teachers must take credits in subjects related to their employment, endorsement area, or program leading to endorsement Believe it or not, this has not been a requirement certification in the past. One of the constitutional responsibilities of the state is to set proper standards for its students. The State Board of Education has set the direction for developing and implementing student standards for nearly 20 years. Student standards currently include broad content standards and detailed grade level expectations, English language proficiency standards, alternate performance standards for students with significant cognitive disabilities, and cultural standards. Since February 2010, the department, Alaska educators, and industry representatives have engaged in a process to replace the current content standards in reading, writing, and math with more rigorous grade level standards. The focus has been to ensure that the standards outline a path for students to graduate high school, college ready, and career ready. And the new Alaska standards will be inclusive of all grade levels K-12, unlike the current K-10 standards. The revision of grade level expectations will follow after the standards adoption by the board. Undoubtedly, you are aware of the Common Core standards that have come down as a national movement. Many states have adopted these standards, but Alaska did not. We decided early on that we would use our Alaska standards as a baseline to improve as well as compare to the Common Core. What has been developed is more rigorous than the Common Core, and the development has been done by Alaskans for Alaskan students. I'd like to give you just a brief chronology of standard development so you fully understand that these standards were not simply created by the board or the department, but indeed are a product of Alaskans, education, industry, and the community. Between February 10 and November 2010, the Standards Review Committee was formed. This committee was made up of K-12 educators, and they met to compare Alaska standards with the Common Core standards. From January 2011 through November 2011, input was gathered from English language arts teachers, grades 3-12, math teachers, grades 3-12, special education teachers, other experienced educators, coaches from the state system of support, university folk, CTE program teachers, and industry representatives. Representatives who work with students with disabilities, English language learners, economically disadvantaged students, and students from ethnic subgroups met to ensure that all have equal access to the new Alaska standards. And the new Alaska standards are aligned with college-ready and work-ready training expectations. They include rigorous content and application of knowledge through higher order skills. They build upon strength and lessons of current standards and equal or more rigorous than the Common Core standards and relate to real world applications. At no time in the design of the Alaska standards were they allowed to dip below the rigor of the Common Core. At the December 2011 meeting of the Board of Education, a motion was passed to open up an extended period of public comment for the draft Alaska Career Ready and College Ready standards. After reviewing and discussing all public comment, the board anticipates taking final action on the standards in June 2012. New standards will mean new assessments, so work begins on that aspect immediately. Students will most likely not be assessed on the new standards until spring 2016. Alaska's graduation rate methodology has recently changed to reflect a federal mandate requiring all 50 states to use a uniform graduation rate that is to be reported for all public high schools. I will not presume to take you through that process because I don't want to get you as confused as I, but trust me, Mr. McCormick, Director of Assessment and Accountability Department, would be happy to answer any questions if you're interested in the figuring of that particular rate. Graduation rates are calculated across 4 years. Dropout rates are calculated over 1 year, and because the two rates are calculated independently, they cannot be the inverse of each other. Most people will tell you if a student did not graduate from high school, he or she is a dropout, and that's not necessarily true. I'm happy to report that our graduation rate has increased significantly over the past 7 years. In 2011, it was 68%, not degrees, and in comparison to 2005 at 61%. A few words about the teacher mentor program. Teacher retention in rural Alaska is a very real issue. When Jim Hickerson was superintendent at Bering Strait, He told me that 85% of their teachers come from outside. There are so many issues for them to deal with. A whole new culture, isolation, cold, transportation, that many spend a year and leave. In 2004, the mentorship program was initiated to increase teacher retention by helping new rural teachers become more effective in their instructional practices within their first 2 years in the classroom. You and I talked briefly last year about the budget cuts of this program. This program does have a positive impact on teacher retention and promising impact on student achievement. This school year, 24 mentors, down from 28 last year, are working with 330 teachers, down from 401 last year, and 142 schools, down from 187 schools last year, in 34 school districts, down from 43 last year. This program does work. From an average rural teacher retention rate of 68%, the mentored teachers have retained at 84% in 2010-11. At the American Education Research Association conference on May 4th, results were presented that showed that although mentoring new teachers did not bring the student standardized test scores up to the same level as students in veterans teachers' classes, they are much closer than expected for reading, writing, and in science. In the case of math, students in classrooms of mentored teachers perform the same as those of classrooms of veteran teachers. There are promising results to start closing the achievement gap typically seen between the students of new and veteran teachers. Through a grant from the U.S. Department of Education, Northwest, and UA statewide, we'll evaluate the effects of mentoring on teacher retention and teacher effectiveness and student achievement. The details for this evaluation are now being worked out. There's a whole lot going on in the arena of early learning. In 2009, the legislature provided $2 million for a pilot pre-kindergarten program that would include six sites. Proposals from districts were submitted and six sites were selected. The legislature then added two additional sites. The purpose was to allow varied school districts to create preschool programs that incorporate Alaska's early learning guidelines in ways tailored to their local communities. The two-year report was a part of the board packet for our January teleconference. I'm not going to go through all the findings except to state that many children showed exceptional growth, but there are still children performing below expectations. For all Alaska's children to close the gap by their third year grade assessments, continuous growth must begin in early childhood and be sustained through the primary grades. Cooperation and collaboration between Head Start and school districts positively affects the learning and development of young children. The board endorsed the department's family engagement plan, which includes action steps for parents, teachers, and community members that will ultimately impact student achievement. This, in conjunction with early literacy plan that provides actions that parents, caregivers, preschool teachers, and community members can do, will help students come to school ready to learn. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that in my experience, I am convinced that school readiness and parent involvement coupled with high-quality teachers is the only thing that's going to impact student achievement. State system of support. Throughout the year, the board heard reports on state system of support activities. The Third Leadership Institute and the Alaska Literacy Institute, which was sponsored for intervention districts and included representatives from pre-K programs and Head Start programs, the curriculum exposure analysis done by the state, and activities of the UPIC school district. The board received updates to the development of a rubric on cultural standards for educators as a follow-up to our adoption of this section from the publication Alaska Standards for Culturally Responsive Schools. The department responding to its constitutional responsibilities, funding, standards, assessments, and oversight and support. We are currently intervening in three districts in direct response to our oversight responsibility where students have chronically low performance. Two districts have come out of intervening status after raising student performance and building capacity. Alaska's Learning Network, this is a little bit, a few words on distance education. improve student achievement by providing distance courses taught by highly qualified Alaska teachers. A network of support for educators and students to collaborate and share resources in a digital repository. Professional development for teachers. Alaska Learning Network provides rigorous courses that meet eligibility requirements for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. And just this morning, I was watching the news, and an ad came on for the Native Science and Engineering program, and one of the students was on the ad and said they had been taking online classes, and she was just felt very proud because she had seven credits when she entered college. She will have that. So the online thing does work. Mount Edgecombe High School is a state-operated boarding school in Sitka for approximately 400 high school students from around the state. 78% of the students self-identify as Alaska Native. The state board, which serves as the Board of Education for Mount Edgecombe, recently worked on some credit requirement changes with Superintendent Randy Hawk. In order for Mount Edgecombe students to meet the credit requirement of Alaska Performance Scholarship, the board reduced the required credits in social studies from 5 to 4 and added a required credit in either social studies or math or science beyond courses already required. The total number of required courses stayed at 24. Really tweaking for that scholarship. In November, Commissioner Hanley, Deputy Commissioner Morse, Board First Vice Chair Jim Mariner, and I attended Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's two-day education summit. The upshot of the summit was exactly what our board and department are dedicated to: world-class leadership, teachers and principals, community engagement and involvement, greater expectations for student success, and expand choice and opportunity for all students. Where have you heard that before? Seems we are all on the same wavelength, which basically is providing the best educational opportunity for each and every student in our state. What's on the horizon? Teacher evaluation tied to student achievement. And ladies and gentlemen, if we're going to want to continue receiving federal dollars, this is a reality. And it's a much more convoluted idea than at first blush. But the Teacher Quality Committee is wrestling with this whole concept as we speak. And the Teacher Quality Committee is a committee that is approved by the State Board. And it includes many, many more people from the Alaskan community through industry, the union, lots of folks. That's where I'm going after this meeting. Continue to monitor the department work with intervention districts. Dialogues with boards and with the board and superintendents of intervention districts. Report from districts who have exited intervention. How did it go? What was good? What could have been done better? A board session on strategic planning. Continuation of the implementation of the state career and technical education plan. Certainly more work on the new Alaska standards and the assessments to go with those standards. And monitor and amend regulations as needed for the APS. And we talked about this at the Finance Committee, the House Finance Committee yesterday, but I need all of you to hear that while I still have your attention, I want to tell you about a bird that's been under my saddle blanket for ever since I've been on the board, and that's about 9 years. I've leaned on every commissioner about this, but there's an old adage, you can't get blood out of a turnip. I know that Representative Dick has questioned the makeup of the board, and our board has nothing to do with that. We do have everything to do with where we meet, however. This is a statewide board that we are talking about, and because of budget constraints, we only meet in Anchorage, Fairbanks, not often, and Juneau. We did wander up to the Matsu this past year, but in anybody's definition, that's not rural Alaska. I think it's imperative that this board meet in rural Alaska once a year. In my tenure on the board, we have met in Galena, Kotzebue, and Mount Edgecombe. I truly think the argument could be made the board should meet at Mount Edgecombe once a year. Meeting in these places was a great education for all board members. Even though we are broad and open-minded individuals, it is difficult to represent the diversity of our state when we don't have the opportunity to experience it. The operation of the board falls within the executive administration portion of the department's budget, and specifically the travel portion's been cut. Even though our commissioners' travel expenses are down from previous years, we are unable to find the department's budget funding for this board to gain a firsthand understanding of areas in Alaska in which we don't live or meet. The obvious question will be around costs and why the department cannot travel the board in the current budget. Personally, I can't answer all those questions, but I do know that for the board to travel to rural Alaska, we're looking at $15,000 to $20,000. This does not include department staff. So I would ask, no, I would implore you to consider my request during this legislative session. It certainly would help us become an even more effective board. And before I wrap it up, I need to tell you that as I put together this report, I was amazed and proud of what this board has accomplished. We are a volunteer board, and we meet face-to-face 4 times a year. I continue to be very proud to serve. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. After our conversation yesterday in the subcommittee, we really do need to come up with the finances so you can go out and interface with the folks that are beyond the, I refer to them as pavement people. So, thank you. Representative Pruitt, you have had a question?
I do. One of the things I want to ask you about, you mentioned the HSGQE and the fact that you guys are again, showing your support for it. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask just kind of a couple different questions related to it, and just to help understand where the board was going, why they continued to show the support. One of the questions that I've heard from both teachers and parents is that there's concern that maybe that the test that we have, and as you mentioned, that it's at minimum standards is where we've established it, that maybe we might be in some cases teaching to that test. So some of the reasons that our kids might not be excelling beyond it is because we're putting so much time in making sure that they just hit the test standards. And obviously that's a concern of seeing them excel past that. Another one of the things that I've heard from some teachers actually was a concern that because we give it on multiple different times, in 10th grade, there have been some 10th graders that have taken it, and it's, okay, I've taken it, now I'm done. And they won't put the effort in the remaining couple years of school. And in some cases, it's because they're bright kids, and then maybe they understood they already got it. And as you even indicated, quite a few of the kids do pass that at the 10th grade. How do we make sure that they're engaged after they've taken this test, so that they continue to, you know, show the Excel? Of course, we've got our scholarship, but I mean, not all of them will want to take all those classes, and that's fully within their decision. But what are we making sure? How are we making sure that they remain engaged and don't just kind of go through the motions in the last portions of the years? And the last question that I'd have related to that, and I apologize for throwing these all on you. Is I've also had some concerns, and specifically this has come from some of the special education individuals, is there's some kids that struggle with taking tests, and what are we doing to make sure that they're not limited I had one teacher last year that gave me quite a little deal right after she had to tell several of her students that they had for the final time not been able to pass the test after taking it multiple times, and they had done well in the other classes, but as soon as they got to the test, they couldn't concentrate. Everything was on the line, and they faltered. I just want a clarification. I'm glad you guys we're trying to find how we get this minimum line, how we make sure our students are at a certain level, but I also want to make sure that it's not limiting what we're doing for our kids, that we're encouraging them to continue to excel. And I just want to understand from the framework where the board went, what was going this last year, what was the thought process in continuing it, and where is the future going in this? Because obviously you're changing the standards, and the test would probably have to adjust to that. If you could maybe speak to that for a moment.
Well, you always hear that kids say, well, you know, I passed this exit exam when I was grade 10, and now I don't have to go to school anymore. I think that's a very, very small percentage of youngsters. The whole idea with passing the minimum competency test or exam is it should give information. And with counseling and guidance and even teachers themselves saying, you know, this, we've pointed this out, this is where you are and this is where you need to be. And it gives them some good baseline for improving their curriculum growth. When I think about my own grandkids taking the test, nobody ever considered quitting school because he or she, you know, passed that test, that's for sure. And I don't think it's even presented to kids that way. Kids very often, you know, okay, well, I've done this, then I'm finished. I know as a curriculum principal, one of my biggest disappointments when I was scheduling kids all the time was that they just say, what do I have to take, you know? And just give me the basic stuff. What do I have to take and then I can get out of here? So maybe that particular youngster thinks, well, I've done this. Okay, it's just one hoop that you have to get through, fella, you know, and that we're going to move forward from there. So I think it takes some pretty straight talk and some guidance on the kid's part. As far as our dialogue, we exhausted dialogue on this particular subject because it's been a key issue for a long time. One of the comments that you make is very true. Some students do not test well. Some students will never pass this exam. The law says it is a high-stakes test. You either pass it or you don't graduate, and you get a certificate of attendance. Now, that's a hard thing to deal with. It becomes something that you sort of wrestle with inside, but basically it says that the student has learned the basic skills. And now when you have a high-stakes test, the bottom line is some students are not going to pass it. Not everybody passes the Board of Regents test in the New York public school system. So, you know, if you can live with that, then you can move forward. As for teaching to the test, you know, I teach English. It would be very easy to be accused of teaching to the test when I say these are the basic skills you're required to have. We're going to learn them in this classroom, you know. I don't know. I know that with advanced placement courses, you better believe those teachers teach to the test because parents expect their kids, when they take the advanced placement test, to pass from 3 or above because they want them to have those advanced placement credits when they matriculate to college. So it may happen. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. But it seems like to me it makes good common sense for a teacher to take a look and say, these are the expected basic skills, and it's my job to get them taught.
Representative Feige.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about the qualifying exam, but I think Representative Pruitt's question took care of that. On the Alaska Performance Scholarship, obviously they're providing motivation to the students and possibilities for education that otherwise perhaps they wouldn't have. One of the things I've always been disappointed about it that scholarship is only good for Alaska-based universities, essentially for the University of Alaska. Is there any advantage to expanding the utility of that scholarship program by allowing students to use it in other institutions outside the state of Alaska? Perhaps curricula that are not offered in the state, so as to be able to bring those skills back to the state?
That truly is a legislative issue. When this law was designed, when this performance scholarship was designed, one of the issues, as I understand it, and you're the legislator, is that we wanted to keep our bright youngsters home. And we want them to matriculate through our university system because I think there are facts that, and there's data to prove that students locate close to where they have attended university. Now, sitting back in the audience is the lady who really has all the statistics and is going to be giving them to you on the Alaska Performance Scholarship, which you're going to like to hear, by the way. My belief is that when this was created, the idea was to help keep students at home. Thus, they had to matriculate at an Alaska school, accredited school.
We have time for one more question. And Esther, if we could maybe get you online somewhere down the road, because I know we all have lots of questions. If we, okay, Representative Wilson, then Representative Sisna.
By the way, did I come even close to answering your question?
You help.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Esther, when you were discussing the exit exam and going through it, did you ever think about that maybe the kids should know the basic skills before they get to high school, and then we build on those after we, so that maybe that test should be taken in eighth grade, and it would be perfectly okay for the teachers to teach to the test as kids are going up through eighth grade. Then they should know the basic skills so that high school can be doing more with that. So did it ever, was that ever talked about?
Representative Wilson, I can't think of anything we didn't talk about. Perfectly honestly. Even I got weary of it. But, basic skills become more difficult, too, as you progress. And so, the decision was made that the basic skills that you should have at grade 10, I would assume that basic skills at grade 8, if I'm teaching writing, for example, an 8th grade writing class, that they're going to be different than when I'm teaching a 10th grade writing class. So I think the basic skill level goes up. But you're still on target, because we talked about, is it too late? Should we still be working on basic skills then? But really and truly, school is about basic skills. And
Representative Sisson, I did not see your hand, dear.
Thank you, and I do appreciate it. Thank you so very much. I have real concerns in listening to this, because one of the things that we've been talking about in this committee and others is the fact that we actually have two different kinds of Alaska. We have the Alaska that's urban and the Alaska that's rural. And the urban Alaska is going to be able to answer a lot of the questions on any basic test. And they're going to be able to understand basic standards because they live it. It's where they are. And then there's a huge it's a number that's extraordinarily important and actually expensive. And it's an expensive part of our population because I think a lot of what we do are the wrong things for that population, and one of them is in education. And we give tests that are high stakes tests to that population. It doesn't fit their world, and the test questions don't come from their world. What I've seen in my almost 70 years now is that you need people with many kinds of skills to make it. And if we live in a very, I'm thinking homogenized, I don't know if that's the right term, but in a world that doesn't require lots of different kinds of thinking and lots of different kinds of skills, then we can have a standard test and get everybody right up to the same thing and live perfectly fine. But if you're going to be dealing with the kinds of problems we're looking at, that we're having to deal with right now, and they've just been recently happening, actually. Some big crashes in economically, socially, environmentally. If we're really going to deal with that, we're going to need lots of different kinds of minds. And a lot of those are people who lived here the longest, people who lived here for thousands of years. And yet, the skills that we're teaching don't fit that model. And those people... And where I come from is actually having worked with kids, high-risk kids, from 1963, I think, was my first experience in the counseling world with high-risk kids. And those kids, when I left 10 years ago, have growing amounts of hopelessness. And hopelessness is something that gets built when you feel as if you're inadequate, that you're not equal to, that you're not able to be successful in something as basic as going to school. And when you have that experience in an urban school, it's probably going to be a little less dramatic than it is when you're in a rural school. And I can't help but think that the imposing the world that we have here on a people who live in a place that you can't live the same way and survive. You have to go out and get your food. You have to deal with prices that are incredibly high, and the resources you used to have are no longer available. Those people are leaving us sometimes the worst possible way. They take their lives, and we lead the nation in that. And I can't help but think that we've got a moral duty and we've got an economic duty to really look at what's happening between the two different populations that live in Alaska. I think the school districts have to. In many ways, they've done some great things, and I've just heard of some of the wonderful things they've done when they've been listening to the elders and really building the school to actually come up to some of the standards that really were required, the skill sets that were required in those places. And that's going the direction, I think, that has to be gone if, in fact, we're going to keep those people that we really need in this state. So when I hear the report that you gave, it feels as if there's a silence in some places that I think has to be listened to. So I just needed to say that. Thank you.
Representative Sisson, I appreciate it. I have about four questions I didn't get to ask either. So if you might be available next Wednesday, we certainly didn't get to Diane Behrens and the Alaska Performance Scholarship Outcome Report. If you'd be available, we'd love to pick this up online if we could. But next Monday, February 6th, 8 a.m., in this room we'll hear superintendent presentation by Bill McLeod, Superintendent Dillingham School District. Commissioner Mike Hanley will speak on HB 256, as well as Dr. Norm Eck, Northwest Arctic Borough School District Superintendent. And with that, Esther, thank you. And with that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Good to see all of you.
Yep. We're adjourned.